Session number 13152, Reel 4.
Wing Commander Parrot, Reel 4.
Yep. Well, the thing went by under the wing again, and so I circled round and asked if I could fire anyway. And the controller said, well, no, you'd better not. We're not sure where the Anson is, and our plot has faded anyway. So I left the thing and came down, and we talked and talked and talked about it. And I think it was about 24 hours later, somebody came up with the answer, and they said, I know what it was. It was the Midnight Met Balloon. And that's obviously what it was. That's why it was climbing so fast, too. I was worried about it climbing because there was a cloud layer at about 8,000 feet and it was rapidly getting close to it.
So, whilst you were in Scotland, it must have been, although you had a few operations, quite a good rest, really.
Oh, yes. Yes, well, certainly, yes. Yeah. Oh, it was on the 20... Oh, towards the end of December. September, I mean. About the 26th. Must have been the 26th, I think. Because somebody came along, I can't know who it was now, saying that they wanted volunteers from experienced pilots to go down back to the south, to join squadrons down there. Because 145 by this time had become a C squadron, which is was a training squadron, although it had an operational role as well. And a lot of the new pilots we'd brought in and trained up, they'd gone down earlier on. And they wanted experienced pilots this time. And they wanted four. Well, there were only four of us, I think, in the flight. So we all took the mandatory step backward together and went off down to the south again. Jimmy Storer was one of these. He went to a special flight. Derek Ford and I went to 605 Squadron at Croydon. And I've forgotten who the other one was and where he went.
Which territorial area was 605 identified with?
The Kenley sector.
No, I mean, the other one was County of Durham.
Oh, 605 is County of Warwick.
Was it much different from County of Durham Squadron?
Oh, yes. There were only two. When I arrived, there was one auxiliary pilot left, and that was Ralph Hope. And he was killed soon after I arrived. And then Edge came back to command 605. But that was later on. It was in, I think, late November or even early December. I'm not sure. The squadron commander when I arrived was Walter Churchill. But his flight commanders had grounded him because he was too old. This happened to more than one squadron commander. It happened to my squadron commander in 145, Dusty Miller. Boydie and Roy Dutton told him not to fly, wouldn't let him fly. He was too old. He was, actually.
How old was that?
Oh, he must have been knocking on 40, I would think. I don't think he was quite a First World War pilot. I'm not sure. No, I don't think he was. No, he must have been 37, 38, I suppose. He seemed ancient because he was grey-haired and going rather bald, too. Or was thin on top. Walter Churchill left a few days after I arrived and Archie McKellar took over. Now, Archie was an auxiliary, but he was 602 Squadron Auxiliary, Archie McKellar, well-known name. Very brave, brave Scot, little Scotsman. He had been one of the flight commanders. Jock Muirhead took over his flight. Archie was killed the day after the Battle of Britain ended. Jock McKellar went not long after that. And Bunny Current was running the squadron for some time until Jerry Edge came back. Bunny Current's still alive, do you know him?
No, but I'd welcome his address.
He lives down at in Dorset, or Devon, can't remember the name. A long time ago, actually. But he's a nice chap, Bunny. Good fella.
But when you joined the squadron at Croydon, were things very active?
Yes.
Towards the end of September?
Yes. Yes, they were. There were some big raids still coming up the Thames estuary that we went after. They were always sort of, escorted by 109s, and it was not easy to get into the bombers at all. And you didn't hang around waiting to see what effect you'd had on the aircraft either, on what you'd shot at. I mean, I shot at all sorts of things. Whether I hit them or not, I don't know. The millions of rounds of ammunition that were flying around in the air at that time, they must have hit something. I don't think I made any claims at all.
Did you feel at this stage that the fate of the country was at stake?
No, we were winning the battle by that time, we reckoned. They certainly hadn't reached a position where they could have mounted an invasion. The RAF was still far too strong for them. It was an amazing time, really, which is a pretty platitudinous thing to say. But no, we wondered how long it could go on. We thought it couldn't go on much longer, but it did. It went on for another 2 or 3 weeks into October, really. Although I know October the 31st is the end. Hitler had called it off at about the 12th of October, I think, hadn't he?
I forget.
I remember rightly. I think it was. But he's, he sent out a signal or a message saying that the invasion would not be mounted this year, but preparations were to be kept in hand should a further decision to invade be made in the following spring. And in the meantime, the Luftwaffe were to keep up their pressure on the Royal Air Force, or something like that. So there were only two big raids which I saw, and I couldn't tell for the life of me what day it was. It must have been very soon after I got there, down there, so it must have been in early October. There was a big bomber raid, escorted, came up the Thames. I think we got it turned back, actually. That had been the 31st of... No, that would be the 1st of November, the day that Archie McKellar was shot down. That's right. Then after that, they started the high-flying 109s. With the random bomb, which they dropped from about 20,000 feet or more. And we used to go up and try and intercept them, but they were such a hell of a height. It took... We got to 25,000 feet in 27 minutes on one occasion, I think it was. And we heard later that a Spitfire squadron got a rocket from Keith Park, who'd been shadowing them, because they'd taken 27 minutes to get to the same height. The Hurricanes had beaten them to it. But apart from that, there wasn't a lot going on. There was a stick of bombs across the far side of the airfield. We had a row of semi-detached houses in Forester's Row, which is on the west side of Croydon. The inhabitants had been evacuated somewhere else. from these particular houses. They were right on the border. We walked out through the back garden onto the airfield, which was fine. And, of course, we slept there and we had the mess there. And we had an upstairs anteroom for some reason in one of the houses where we played. The furniture was a card table and four chairs, as far as I remember, and no carpet on the floor. And we played bridge up there. Bunny Carrand always sat with his tin hat on, because he'd heard bombs before around Croydon. But there it was.
Was Croydon Airport much knocked about when you arrived?
Oh, yes, they'd knocked the hotel down and the hangars were pretty sorry. We were on the far side by that time. Originally, of course, I think the squadron had been on the west, on the east side, but when they moved into the villas or semi-detached, they moved the aircraft across to the west side, which was a much better idea. It was a good squadron, a friendly squadron, a lot of good chaps in it. I'm just racking my brains. It was all this high flying. It was so darn cold in the hurricane at 25,000 feet. What happened? Something happened. Jerry was told not to fly for some reason. The two flight commanders, who by that time were Bunny Carrand and Alec Ingall, they had been told to go on rest because they'd had enough. It didn't surprise me. And I found myself being asked by Jerry Edge, who was grounded, "Do you think you could lead the squadron, Peter?" So I said, "Yes, OK." And off we were scrambled, and off we went. Climbed up to some enormous height because of these wretched high-flying things. We got right down over towards, down near, Folkestone, past Beachy Head, I think, and we were about 27,000 feet, and these wretched aircraft, these wretched 109s, were still above us. They were passing that way, and I started to turn, trying to get underneath them, but behind them, you know, but it was a fairly fruitless attempt, really, because as I looked behind me, I realised that all the other chaps had spun off. They couldn't take it, or whatever it was. I'd only got about three of them left with me out of 12. It was fruitless and quite impossible to get up to the 109s. But that went on through November, and then on December the 1st, what were we doing? We were scrambled. It was a Sunday. It was a cold, clear, blue sky. A bit of frost and a bit of ground mist on the ground, but nothing very much. Beautifully clear, lovely winter's day, cold day. And off we went. And I was weaving this time. You know, the business of going backwards and forwards above the squadron to try and protect the rear end. We used to have two, one above and one below, but on this occasion, or maybe we'd stopped the second one, we only had the top we were going, that was me. We got down just north of Brighton, climbing up, I think at about getting on for 20,000 feet we'd reached then, and the controller said, "There's nothing, the nearest bandits are 20 miles east of you." And at the same time, he vectored us. We had been flying southeast. He vectored us to the east, so there was a turn to be made. It was a bit more than, it wasn't quite 90 degrees, but it was a fairly sharp turn. And I was caught on the outside of my weave on the right as they turned left, and I got left behind. So I was feeling a bit lonely. And the controller said that bandits were 20 miles away still. And I didn't think about checking on how many seconds they needed to meet up with us, but I straightened up momentarily just to catch up the squadron again, which was probably about half a mile ahead of me. And the next thing was there was a tracer whistling round my ears and going past me and overtaking me, and a few bangs in the back of the aircraft. I did my evasive action again. And this time I knew I'd collected quite a lot of bullets because the engine was running roughly. And I checked the ailerons and the rudder meters are okay, but the rudder was... that was gone. I don't know what happened to it, whether it was actually shot away or whether it cut the rudder cables. And the engine was running fairly roughly, and there was some oil swilling around in the bottom of the cockpit somewhere on the run on the runners for which are heels. And I wasn't very happy about it at all. I tried to make a radio call to the squadron commander as soon as it happened, obviously, and he didn't get it, and I presume that the radio had been shot out again, very likely. Radio was on the port side, just behind the armour plating in the fuselage. And then I went straight down, looked up above, and the chap wasn't following me, whoever he was. I thought, well, I think I'd better go home with this wreck. And then I realised that I wasn't getting enough power out of the engine to stay airborne. And I got down to about 2,000 feet. I was still going quite fast. I was still looking for an airfield or a big field to land in. But, of course, all the decent fields for landing in were covered in obstructions to stop the Germans from landing in them, which didn't please me very much. And then I saw a flash of flame from the cowlings or from the exhaust stubs. I don't know what it was, but that was enough for me. I'd been down to see a friend of ours who'd been shot down. He hadn't been burnt, but he was in a ward with some people who had been burnt, and you've seen all the bandages and things. And that rather rocked me back on my heels. In fact, I don't know why. I think it wasn't just that. It was the smell of ether and so on. I passed out. I fainted at the foot of the chap's bed. And they put my head down between my knees, and I was all right again. But anyway, I wasn't going to have any of that burning around my face if I could avoid it. And I panicked, rather. I slid the hood back and stood up and got thrown straight on my back by the slipstream. And then I decided I hadn't disconnected the oxygen mask and the... a radio lead, so I was on my back and I had to reach forward with my left hand and pull those out. And then I wriggled again and I stuck for a moment, and then I suddenly slid off down the top of the fuselage and hit the tail fin with my arm there. A hell of a clout. And it sort of dazed me slightly, and the next thing I was out in midair, spread-eagled, all completely spread-eagled, legs and arms right out, and thought I'd better pull my ripcord, and I tried to move my right arm in, and it didn't do anything. And so I had to get my thumb under the D-ring and pull it that way. And I had time to think, oh, God, the thing's not going to open, when it did. it's 3/5 of a second, but you have time to think that it's failed. Because there is that slight delay. You expect it to open up straight away. And then, of course, I got the usual sensation as the canopy deployed, I suddenly felt that I was going up. You're not, of course, but it's just the pressure on you being slowed down. And I was swinging in the parachute. I swung 3 times. I dropped the D-ring, which was a pity. I lost it. I swung 3 times, and I was coming down to the field, grass field, which was fine. And I hit the ground on my right side. I was still swinging downwards like that, so it was a clout, and that did that knee in. The clout on my shoulder, too, had severed a nerve down there, so that my deltoid muscle wasn't working properly. Or it wasn't working at all, I don't think. And I just lay there, and it was quiet. There wasn't a sound. This is about 8:30 in the morning. I was nice and warm. I wasn't cold. I had a sidcut. Well, I shouldn't have been either. I had a sidcut and about 5 more layers of clothing underneath, including a sheepskin waistcoat and a couple of pullovers. And I just lay there, and I thought, no, isn't this lovely? And then I began to think, it's so quiet. am I still here or am I there, so to speak, the next world? And then I heard some footsteps shuffling through the grass, and so I opened one eye and looked up. And there was a pair of black boots, large boots, muddy boots, and then the corduroy trousers tied up with string round the bottom, just underneath the knees, and an old poacher's jacket, I should think it was, and it was all crowned by a black helmet with WP on it. WP stood for, I can't know. I don't know. I never did know. War something, I suppose. And it was a local farm worker. And he asked me if I was all right, and I said, yes, I think so. And I started to stand up. I felt my knee then. And he said, I'll be having them Germans down here last week. I said, oh, yes, that's interesting. He said, yeah, I saw him get out, and I thought you'd left it too late that time. As if I'd been doing it every day, and I left it too late all of a sudden. However, we were walking over towards the farmhouse, which, again, was about a couple of hundred yards away, and an army staff car screeched to a standstill in the road, which was, not far away, and a couple of army officers got out and came over and took me away. They took me back to their mess. It was in Lewis, I think, in the barracks in Lewis. And everybody was at church by this time, except the one medical orderly, who had a look at my shoulder. My knee, there was nothing they could do about that, because I'd had that water on the knee as playing rugby as a young man. But in fact, it turned out that it was worse than I thought. But anyway, he had a look at my shoulder, and it was aching like hell. And he put a pad of cotton wool underneath it, and that took the ache away, which was rather nice. And I just got dressed again when the rather busybody MO came in and said, I'd better have a look at it. You see, and I had to undress again. And he said, took the cotton wool out, said, you don't need that. And my shoulder started aching. And I didn't like to say, well, would you put it back? It hurts. He was the MO, he should know. Anyway, I went into the mess, and he was bloody official, because you can't have a drink because you're maybe suffering from concussion. I wasn't suffering from concussion, at least I don't think it was. So I couldn't have a drink. I got a cup of coffee instead. And then they drove me home, back up to Croydon. They were going to send me on a train, and I thought, not bloody likely, not carrying a parachute like this. It was all over, bundled together. They made an excuse to go up to London so that they could justify the use of the staff car. I got up, and our own doctor, Doc Gagan, who was a great chap, he sorted me out, gave me a sleeping pill. And eventually, this thing was another day or two, and I said, it still hurts like hell. And he sort of felt around it, and he said, well, I think you might have broken something. You better go and have an X-ray. And I had broken the collarbone. Whereupon they put me in an aeroplane splint. Have you seen an aeroplane splint?
No.
People walking around that. it makes a useful shelf for the beer can to tank. And that was about pretty almost the end of my tour of duty on fighters, the first one. The squadron moved up to Malmstrom Heath. We had the first... In fact, I jumped out of the number 4 issue of the Hurricane Mark II. The squadron went up to Malmstrom Heath. We were there for a little while. That's where we met Douglas Bader. And then they were moved on to... I was just starting to fly again. Then it was about 8 weeks before I could... The Hurricane undercarriage and flap lever... are combined in one lever, and it's an odd lifting motion, lifting and forward, to push the. It's an H gate, and to the right, I think, was the undercarriage, and it's lift and push forward, and the flaps were on the left, and the same thing for lifting the flaps or lifting the undercarriage, and then you pushed them down to lower them both. And I just didn't have any strength in this hand to do this lifting motion. So I just couldn't fly. I tried it once, and I didn't get the undercarriage up even. I just had to come around and fly. You know, it was an air test, see if I could do it. And I just started to fly again, and I was okay. I was still having to be a bit clever about lifting the undercarriage and things. I had to brace my elbow on my knee to give me leverage to lift the lever. And we moved on to... We weren't really very operational at Martlesham Heath. We were doing test flights, and in the way of sorting out fuel consumptions, rates of climb and all sorts of things on these Mark II Hurricanes to see how they compared with the Mark I's, presumably to establish how much better we were and what extra things we could do which the Hurricane I couldn't. Anyway, we moved from there to Turn Hill sector, and we were only there a few days, and I was posted to the Central Flying School to be a flying instructor.
Let's jump ahead now, because your next operational squadron, I think, was 501.
Yes.
Which you joined in at the beginning of June 43.
That's right.
Can you tell me about joining that squadron and back to operations?
Well, 501 was the most mobile squadron I came across, I think, because I was told to go down to Tangmere. I arrived at Tangmere and they told me, no, they've gone to Martlesham Heath 2 weeks ago. And I went to Martlesham Heath and I was there for two nights and we went off to Ringwood. We were a week at Ringwood with no operations at all, and we were sent down to West Hamnet. And we did one sweep there, and then we posted off to Hawkinge. We had cropped blower Spitfires, the low-level ones, and the duties at Hawkinge were partly to have aircraft on readiness to intercept the Focke-Wulf 190s, which were attacking the coastal towns, and also to reconnoitre the French coast and the French ports for shipping. I did readiness a few times. I scrambled once, but it was a false alarm. And I did two recce trips. I think they were both with... I was a flight instructor by this time, and so I was supernumerary in the squadron. I wasn't a flight commander. A flight commander was a chap named Kynaston, who in fact had not long before been a flight commander in the training school with me. He and I went off on two of these. The first one we got shot at, which we expected to have at Calais and Dieppe and so on, didn't find any shipping at all, nor were we intercepted by any German aircraft. On the second one, going over Boulogne, we both saw a ship in the harbour there. The technique, incidentally, was that you went out on a very low level, I mean on the deck, virtually, and then as you were coming to the port, you poured on all the power, pulled the nose up sharply, climbed up to about 4,000 feet, and as you went leveled over the top of the port so you could see and dip a wing to see what was there, and then dive down back onto the deck again.